Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The FT.
Hello and welcome to World Weekly. I'm Gideon Rachman. This week, the continuing turmoil in the Middle East. And what does the return of Vladimir Putin mean for Russia's relations with the West? We start with events in Egypt. The reoccupation of Tahrir Square by angry crowds has sparked talk of a second Egyptian revolution 10 months after the toppling of Hosni Mubarak. Joining me on the line from Cairo is the FT's correspondent there, Heba Salah. OK, Heba, the demonstrations have been going on for a few days now. What's your sense of what's going to happen next?
Egypt's military rulers are insistent that the elections will go on as planned. But tomorrow, Friday, we are due to have a very big demonstration in Tahrir Square. The generals on the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces have spoken in a press conference today. But what they said is not likely to satisfy people because they have again denied that police fired live ammunition at protesters. They have defended the police, and they've been somewhat disparaging about the young guys who have been in a confrontation with police for 6 days. So I think this will not go down well. People are likely to mass up in Tahrir Square tomorrow, not necessarily followers of particular political groups, though at the core there are always youth activists, those who were at the forefront of the revolution against Mr. Mubarak. They're likely to be there, plus a lot of other people who are sympathizers, who are angry about army rule, feel that the army has mismanaged this transition and won them out.
Does this feel like a replay of what happened in January? Is the support as wide?
The support is less wide. In many ways, it feels like a replay because you've got hundreds of thousands of people packing Tahrir Square. But beyond Tahrir Square, opinion is split. There are many people who say we're on the brink of elections. Let the process unfold. This is destructive. Who takes over if the army leaves? We don't want the army to leave. They see the army as the last remaining barrier between the country and chaos. So there are a lot of people outside Tahrir who say that. Inside Tahrir Square and elsewhere in society, there is a view which says they should go and hand over to perhaps an empowered civilian government which could lead the country out of the crisis. Clearly, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces is not considering such an option. They're not planning to go. They did launch a challenge saying, if you insist that we go, let's hold a popular referendum. And I think they did that confident that a popular referendum would support their point of view.
Now, of course, the situation is moving very fast, so it would be difficult to predict how it's going to play out. But do you think that the Army Council will be able to withstand this public pressure, push ahead with elections, or is it building to a stage where something's got to give?
It really depends on what happens in the next few days. Overnight, they have managed to bring about an end of the fighting in downtown Cairo. The army has erected barriers. Police have been withdrawn into the interior ministry. So the fighting, which actually fed passions because of the dead and the injured and the pictures and all this, and the firing of the tear gas and all this inflamed feeling, if this is over and if this truce holds, then perhaps a it will be possible to hold elections. But if between today and tomorrow, when there will be hundreds of thousands of people in the square, something else happens, matters get out of hand, there is an attempt at a sit-in at the end of the demonstration, which often happens, and then this sit-in is attacked, then it could all reignite, and that would really threaten the election.
Heba Saleh in Cairo, thank you very much indeed. Egypt, of course, is not the only Arab country in turmoil. Violence and civil unrest has been going on in Syria for months, prompting renewed calls for international intervention this week. Abigail Fielding-Smith is following events in Syria from Beirut, and she's on the line now. Abigail, what do you make of these new calls for international intervention?
Well, it's not clear how any of these sort of ideas that are being talked about would actually work in practice. And the most consistently talked about one is the idea of a Turkish buffer zone on the Turkish border. But it's not clear, A, whether Turkey really wants to go ahead and do that. There's a lot at stake in it for Turkey, which, as we saw last week, possibly is already starting to experience some kind of blowback from its increasingly hard stance on Syria. So it's not clear how these would work in practice, and it's not clear how you would get the international support, particularly with sort of Russia's position being as it is.
And yet there is a sense of increasing international isolation for President Assad, with the Arab League calling for him to go, President Erdogan of Turkey even likening him to Hitler. Is he able to isolate himself from the international situation, or do you feel that whether or not there's a UN resolution, that does have some sort of impact on him?
I think it definitely has an impact, and you can sort of tell that from how sort of furiously state media react to these kind of things. And also the economic pressure is building up. Whether or not the Arab League decide today to introduce some sanctions measures, even with the existing sanctions that there are from the EU and the US, there's really a lot of economic pressure on Assad. And I think that the way that impacts the situation is that people in the inside who are currently supporting the regime look at the way the winds are blowing and might start to think, is this really in my interest to keep supporting the regime? Or at least that's the kind of thinking behind it by the sort of proponents of these measures.
Final question on Turkey, their neighbours who are in the forefront of this pressure on them. Do you have a sense that the Turks know what they want now? I mean, there was a period when they were trying to build up this very close relationship between the two presidents, Erdogan and Assad. That's obviously gone to the wind. But do the Turks have a view of how they think this is going to end?
Well, I think, as you say, they invested a lot in this relationship, and it took them a while to really accept that they sort of had to write it off. The indicators now from the public statement sort of coming out of Ankara are that they have written it off, but they are still very reluctant to sort of take things to the next level, because there's all kinds of ways in which it could come back and hurt them economically if they were to impose sanctions. But also, Assad has all kinds of cards he could play, such as the PKK, a sort of militarized Kurdish group who have a sort of branch in Syria. Turkey and Syria have very bad relations because of Syria's support for the PKK, which only ended relatively recently. So, potentially that's something Syria could do to stir up trouble in Turkey. And so my sense, just from sort of seeing the public statements that come out, is that, they have decided they've given up on this relationship, but they're treading very carefully in terms of what to do, having made that decision.
And actually, I'll finish with a probably unanswerable question, I'm afraid. But given all the factors, internal and external, how long do you give President Assad?
that's the question that everyone in various diplomatic missions across the Middle East are asking themselves at the moment. If there is a kind of consensus, in as much as there is a kind of consensus, I think that the regime itself has proved surprisingly durable in spite of reports of increasing army defections at a kind of low level. And in terms of the economic pressure, the feeling is that with sort of help maybe from Iran, they can probably brazen it out. They're not about to just collapse sort of imminently. But what people tell me when I sort of ask them this question is it'll be one of those things a bit like the Arab Spring itself, where you can see the conditions are there, but you won't know when it happens until it happens, and it could happen soon or it could be in years' time. But, you know, clearly none of the kind of macro factors are very sustainable in the long term, but no one can really see what will sort of trigger an actual collapse.
Thanks very much. Finally, to Russia, which is preparing for the all but inevitable return of Vladimir Putin as president when elections are staged next March. The FT's Neil Buckley was part of a small group of journalists who recently dined with Mr. Putin. He joins me now. Neil, what was your impression? Is the new Putin much like the old Putin? Is he unaltered after his 4 years out of the presidency?
I think the new Putin is very much like the old one. We were all very interested to see what kind of Mr. Putin this was going to be. There's been a lot of talk that we might see a Putin 2.0 who will be a more reformist, somewhat more liberal figure than in the past. But the impression at the dinner we had with him was that he still thinks and views the world very much in the way that he did before.
And that is to see Russia as rather put upon by the rest of the world, a Russia that needs to defend its interests with the rest of the world, so the rest of the world doesn't take advantage of it, seemed to be his basic take.
Absolutely. And it was very much like going back to 2007, 2008, the end of his last presidency. He's still very concerned about the US plans for a missile shield in Central Europe. He spoke very critically about that. He was extremely critical about the NATO-led intervention in Libya, suggested this was a gross violation of the UN Security Council resolution. So a lot of very tough words. But he accuses the US and the West of double standards. He says, we are not allowed to do the things that you are. He is talking about creating a Eurasian Union of former Soviet republics, and said that Western criticism of that was double standards. He said, you're integrating, why can we not do the same things?
So it sounds like Russia, if and when President Putin comes back to power, will go back to being one of the West's major foreign policy headaches, because I guess one of the achievements of President Obama has been this reset with Russia, which has calmed things down. Is that all the gains from the reset? Do you think they're now at risk?
I think the reset's certainly in question. We've seen the comments by Mr. Putin repeated this week and built upon by Dmitry Medvedev, who, of course, is still president for the time being. He has made a very outspoken speech about the missile shield. And so there are really a lot of questions about the reset and whether this was actually just a temporary thaw and we could see things freezing over again. But of course, a lot depends on what happens in the US presidential elections. If we were to see a Republican win those, then of course all bets will be off in a sense over the reset.
And one shouldn't forget that just before Obama came in, things were really very bad between the US and Russia, with the arguments over the war in Georgia and so on. So they could get pretty bad again.
They could get bad again. They're still a lot better than they were at their low point in 2008. But right now, the prognosis doesn't look terribly positive.
Last thing, though, what about the domestic background that President Putin is coming back to? I mean, is the economy strong enough to support a kind of feel-good factor when he comes back into the Kremlin? Because one notices this unprecedented thing of him apparently being booed at a martial arts demonstration.
I think that that's the most interesting thing about the situation right now, is that those of us who were there a couple of weeks ago for a big conference and then the meeting with Mr. Putin, there was a real sense of the mood having changed in Russia. And I felt this on previous visits this year, that people are getting a bit restive. Certainly the elites, as Russians like to call them, the intelligentsia, the business community, are not wild about the idea of Mr. Putin coming back as president. The question is the extent to which that feeling is shared among ordinary Russians, and whether any of them would actually be prepared to act on that. It's very difficult to tell. We may get an indication in the parliamentary elections in a week and a half's time with the performance of United Russia, the pro-Kremlin party. But certainly the economic outlook is not as strong in the coming years. There's a real sense that Russia needs to modernise its economy, modernise its whole system of governance. And a lot of questions about whether Mr. Putin and a man of his instincts can really deliver on that kind of modernisation.
And indeed, rather ominously, wasn't his spokesman praising the Brezhnev era as a good time for Russia?
Yes, I don't think that was his spokesman's finest hour, actually. But it does. There has been a lot of talk about comparing Mr. Putin with Brezhnev. If he comes back as expected as president, he could be around for another 12 years on top of the 12, 13 years he's already been around. So you could be talking about a quarter century with the same man in charge.
Daunting prospect. Neil Buckley, thank you very much. And thanks also to Heber Salah in Cairo and Abigail Fielding-Smith in Beirut. That's it for this edition. Please join us again next week.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Hurry into Menards and save big money. Stock up on water softener Salt for softer skin and cleaner clothes. Diamond Crystal is the perfect choice of salt to minimize water softener tank residue. It helps your soaps and detergents clean better while increasing the life of your appliances and plumbing. Save big on Diamond Crystal products at Menards. And don't forget to check out the flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big.